What's up, family? You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We are joined today by a guest we have had on the show to discuss the avalanche of political and social attacks on transgender people in this country. Today, they join us to talk about their new book, American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Our guest is Nico Lange. Lange is a journalist, editor, culture critic, and essayist. Lange is the founder of Queer News Daily and has previously worked as the deputy editor of Out Magazine, an LGBTQ plus correspondent for Vice, the news editor at Them, and a contributing editor at Extra Magazine. Nico Lange, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here.
I said this before I hit record, but I always want more time with you when we chat, and now we have it. The book's dedication, Nico Lange says, to Terry Bruce and Henry Berg Brosseau, who gave their lives for us, to next Benedict and A.C. Morrison, who deserve better. Tell me about those folks.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. So Terry Bruce was a trans advocate in South Dakota whose story I heard about while writing the book. He took his own life, unfortunately, so he didn't make it. But I wanted to find a way to mention him in the chapter itself because it felt really important to like honor his legacy and honor everything that he gave for us. But I just didn't get a chance to. You know, you sort of have to like make really hard decisions when you're writing a book like this. You have to cut a lot of things that you really don't want to. And the chapter originally was so sprawling, right? And it went all of these different ways. I tried to encompass like all of queer life in South Dakota, but I had to make hard choices to narrow that and to really focus on Wyatt, who is the subject there. That for folks who aren't familiar, you know, I spent a year traveling the country to write American Teenager, which documents the lives of 8 trans teens in 7 different states. You know, 2 of the teens are siblings. So, you know, I got a 2-for-1 deal there. But Wyatt really insisted that he didn't want this story to be like about anything else but him, like that he should get to be the main character in his own life. And I really listened to that. And because of that, it meant that I couldn't tell Terry's story the way I wanted to, but I didn't want to just erase him and erase his life. So I felt it was important to put him there. And then, you know, originally he was going to be the dedication. But then I thought, you know, Henry Berg Brosseau has a similar story. This like trans advocate also took his own life after just like giving so much to our community and like warning queer and trans people of what was coming, right? And I just wanted like another reminder of what he did, like what he gave to the struggle. Because I think that we all are aware of these like 4 fathers and 4 mothers and 4 theys who came before us, who gave so much to us. But we don't always like honor that. Like we don't always like mention their names and make sure they stay in the conversation. So I wanted to just make sure like, you know, people have been doing this work for a long time. Then, you know, the other 2 folks, Next Benedict, that's a case everybody knows really well. That happened while I was writing this book. So that just felt really important to like to honor Next.
For my listeners who may not know.
Yeah, so Next Benedict was an Oklahoma teen who was beaten in a school bathroom by 3 cisgender girls who attacked him while he was using the bathroom. And he died the next day. There are questions about his death and the circumstances surrounding it. So I won't really like comment there. But it's been like that story for me was a moment to reflect on the violence that trans kids are experiencing in their schools and in their communities all the time that often goes unreported on and unremarked on. That was to me the conversation that we should be really having about like what kids are going through and how we can better support them. And that's very much what this book is about. So it just made a lot of sense to mention Next there. But then A.C. Morrison, that's a really personal one for me because I spent I'm still working on it, about 1.5 years tracking her story. She was a trans woman in South Dakota who was killed by a man she met up with through Grindr. And I sort of found out about that case by accident because I happened to be in South Dakota writing and reporting this book while I heard about AC and I tweeted about her case and it started getting like national pickup, like people started paying attention to it. But just locally, the investigation wasn't going anywhere. And even though I didn't really have the time to do it. And I honestly didn't want to do it because I wanted to just focus on this book. I knew that I had a responsibility that if I have the resources, I should do something about it. So I really took that case on, trying to like get justice for her and make sure that like her killer was held accountable. And he was, in fact, through a lot of advocacy, not only for myself, but other journalists, other members of the community, he was arrested and he now faces potentially a life in prison. And I'm not really much of like, how do you say, like, I'm not like a carceral feminist here. I'm not like, you know, let's throw him, you know, lock him up and throw away the key. That's not really my bag. But it just, it makes me happy, though, to see that a trans woman like is getting the justice she deserves, that there is nothing that could ever look like justice. Like there is nothing that could ever like bring her back. But I know her family, that this makes their path a little easier. So that just makes me happy.
That's right. It's funny. This is a total digression, but my mother was on the front lines of the domestic violence movement, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago. And when people call, you know, her and her generation a carceral feminist, I push back because at that time, right, the literal policy in police books was walk the guy around the corner, tell him to calm down, while the other cop told the woman to stop irritating her husband. And women were literally dying. And I think it's similar here, right? And so it's, as we work towards an abolitionist world, it's all roads in. While we also try to address root causes, I think, of hate and violence in this country. But that's another interview, Nico. I'm wondering if you could talk about the political climate that gave rise to the impetus for this book, and maybe starting with the sheer number of anti-trans bills put forth in 2023. How many of those bills were actually passed? And you mentioned, I believe you said, was Henry Berg Brousseau that warned people of what was coming. What were the warning signs? So there's a three-part question there.
Sure. Yeah. You're really putting me through it in this interview. I love it. It's like getting your final exam. It's like, I'm ready. All right. So I'll focus on this year just because that's sort of most front of mind. So this year, more than 650 anti-trans bills have been put forward in states all across the country. We often look at it as like it's a Florida problem. It's a Texas problem. No, we're seeing this in most states. I think that there are only like maybe five states that aren't in session this year that haven't had any anti-trans bills put forward. That's a really small number. So all of the other states in the country are at least seeing one or two bills. And in the case of certain states like Missouri, you're seeing dozens and dozens of bills. And these pieces of legislation, what often makes it easier for politicians to introduce them and to get them passed occasionally is that they erase the real harms in terms of the folks who would be impacted by this, right? That they don't talk about like the lives that would be affected. They pretend that trans people don't exist. And if you're pretending that trans people don't exist, you're not really talking about like the damage that would be caused, right? And with this book, it's so much about the damage. It's so much about the effect and the impact on the daily lives of kids who are really just trying to get by. Because it's not even always that these laws are passed, and that's really harmful. It's often just the sheer introduction of these bills or the threat that they could be introduced that makes people nervous, that makes it harder to be yourself. So many of the kids in this book like fear the introduction of like anti-trans legislation, not during the current legislative session, but the next year, because you don't know what's coming. Like, and especially if you're living in a state like Texas, the last time they met for legislative session, they introduced over 100 anti-LGBT bills, and they're not even waiting for legislature anymore. Like the governor and the lieutenant governor and the attorney general there are sort of pursuing their own path and their own tactics to chip away at rights and protections for trans people. That looks like a lot of different things. That's like repealing the ability of people to get corrected birth certificates, corrected driver's licenses, persecuting parents of trans kids as being quote unquote child abusers, right? And forcing them to undergo these like grueling investigations. That forces people out of the state, and it forces these kids to like have this life where they don't know what their future is. Like it's hard to build a future or to see a future for yourself if you don't know where that future is going to be, like, because you don't know what your life is going to look like. So all of these kids are really, really struggling under the weight of these laws in a lot of different ways. And I do want to highlight that this isn't even just a state legislature thing. So even if you're just, if you're not one of these kids who's living in Texas or Florida, if you live in like a liberal bubble, like Colorado or California or Oregon, this could be coming to your state. This could be like coming to your home, like you could be next. And I think all kids everywhere are very aware of this and they don't really know what to do. So with this book, I really just wanted to give them a platform and to sort of like give them back their voices to be able to say something about it and to educate all of us about like the real impacts here.
If you had to, could you, I want to start here. So I've got a very dear friend of mine who I think just turned 60, just to give a time frame container, whose parents put them in the UCLA, what do you call it? A gender disaffirming, I guess, program. That was 60 years ago, or 50 years ago, right? I think they were in elementary school. How does this point in time differ from other points in time in history? My point in the illustrating with my friend is that trans folks have always been targets and othered. And I guess I'm asking both in terms of the attacks, but also, Nico, in terms of the resistance.
In terms of the resistance, you see that in places across the country. And I really wanted to highlight those organizations that are on the ground doing the work in this book, because, you know, it's not just that these kids are like are the victims of anti-trans legislation and no one's doing anything about it. There are groups on the ground that are dedicated to this fight, that are fighting every single day. And these kids are helping them, like Wyatt Williams, who is the South Dakota subject in the book. At the time, he was 15 years old. He came out when he was a preteen. He told his parents in a letter that he is a trans boy. And, you know, after some tears and hugging, they were very supportive. It took a little bit of time to, you know, educate everybody, to read all the right books and make sure they, you know, understood what all this meant. But they got on board really quickly. It's really like, how do you say, an ideal case for like a trans kid, right? In terms of like having a loving, supportive family. And his mother, Susan, then founded a statewide advocacy group for trans kids called the South Dakota Transformation Project in order to advocate for other families, because they recognized that so many families across the state wouldn't have the kinds of resources that they had, wouldn't have the kind of like strong community of people who are willing to support them and who are there for them. Right. So, you know, Wyatt's family went through their own hardships. They did have, you know, friends that cut them off, you know, neighbors who don't talk to them anymore, that sort of thing. But they've been extraordinarily lucky and they wanted to share that luck with other people. And through that work, not only have they been getting resources to other families and communities across the state, families who really, really, really need resources and don't have anywhere else to go. But they've been fighting at the legislature. They've been trying to like influence policy, you know, talking to lawmakers, hoping to put a face on the issue, just really spending their free time, like educating people to try to make a difference. And it doesn't always work, right? I sat in the room in South Dakota with Susan while she gave a lecture to their local police force in Sioux Falls, and people just didn't listen to her. Like they didn't, those police officers did not care that woman was in the room. They were just kind of like staring up at the ceiling, or, you know, they would roll their eyes, or you could just see like the lack of engagement on their faces. Like they were mentally checked out. They did not want to be here. And even after her, talk was over, the sort of presentation she gave, nobody came up to her and asked questions afterward. You know, they just started like figuring out where their lunch order would be. So I think that disaffection can really impact local activists on the ground. Like it can be really hard to put your heart and your soul into this and hear that like people just don't care about your time and they don't care about like how their actions affect other people. But these groups keep doing it and they keep doing the work. Like it's life-giving, sometimes grueling stuff, but they just keep at it again, like year after year after year. And I do hope that we give those folks their flowers, that we often recognize the work of national organizations who are also doing great work, right? Like, you know, I'm trying to think of a really good example, like the ACLU, right? Like people understand, sorry. Like, yeah, the ACLU. We love the ACLU. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, it's like people recognize that. But we're not always like giving those same kudos to that
I'm
local
sorry,
organization.
I'm going to say to the folks that are actually in the grime, in the grit, and doing the actual work that lets the ACLU exist. I mean, I work with folks from the ACLU for sure. But it is. It's the local, little to no funded, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think they inform each other.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Nico Lang. They have a new book out called American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Nico, we were just talking about, you know, the avalanche of trans legislation, anti-trans legislation that we've been seeing across the country. For a couple of years now, we started earlier in the interview, right? You were telling the story about Next Benedict, which is sort of a good segue to my next question, because even if these laws don't pass, which many of them do, I think I read that in 2023 it was like 75% of them, I think it says in your book, did pass, actually. Even if they don't pass, can you talk about the environment that it creates for trans kids and their families? You know, people are like, well, what are they so upset about? It's just a bathroom. Next Benedict died for using the bathroom.
Yeah, well, think about it. I mentioned this before, but even if the law doesn't pass, these kids don't know that, right? Like, you're operating throughout the year as if this law very well could pass, because it has to, you know, go through all these hurdles and all these obstacles, like before or not, you know, it becomes a law. We've all seen Schoolhouse Rock, so we know how these things work now. But like during that time, you're really like on the edge of your seat, but not in that like exciting, you're in, you know, a good movie way. Like, you are waiting to find out whether or not you'll have rights. Like, and imagine that you're not doing that just once, right? It's not like it happens in 2017 and then it doesn't work and they never try it again. Republicans are relentless. They will do this year after year after year, because when they like keep at it, when they do like keep fighting like for these horrible bills, often they're successful. Right? They do eventually pass them into law. So they're really great at playing the long game and often eventually getting what they want. Like in South Dakota, they did not give up. When they had an anti-trans bathroom bill that was vetoed by Dennis Dugard in 2016, their former governor, they could have just thrown in the towel and been like, well, you know, we see that there's not really an appetite for this. It would, you know, cost us like this horrible like boycott of the state that would cost us up to $1 trillion. So let's just not do this. No, they did not do that. They moved on to other things. They moved on to sports. They moved on to gender affirming care. They moved on to drag shows at colleges and all of these other like pet issues. And they have been extraordinarily successful at some of them. They got the sports bill that they wanted after they kept at it year after year. They got the gender affirming care ban they wanted after they kept at it year after year. And think about that. If you are a trans kid on the ground watching all this, right? You know that, you know, 2017 might not be the year, but 2018 could. Maybe it doesn't happen in 2018, but it could happen in 2020. And how do you build a life around that, right? Waiting for the other shooter drop, never knowing what's going to happen. And with this book, I think you really see the like the real effect on these kids' lives, because it really does, like, it gets at your psyche. It gets at like your self-confidence, your ability to like move through the world with a like bright, happy demeanor. Like, this stuff really, really, really weighs on you. Why it's a great example in that, you know, being a trans boy in South Dakota and watching this happen year after year, going to the legislature with his mom to try to fight this stuff as, you know, part of the South Dakota Transformation Project. Like, he started to have these really horrible headaches. He was missing a lot of school. He was missing the maximum allowable days at school because it was affecting his, like, his health and his well-being so much. And then eventually he makes the decision to like, to this slight spoiler here, but he makes the decision to leave the state over all the stuff that's happening, because like, he just can't live like this. And these kids can't live like this. These families can't live like this, which is why so many of them who have the privilege to do so leave, because they don't want to think about this. They just want to go on with their daily lives. They want to have dinner and like watch a movie and play some board games and do all those mundane family things that everybody else gets to, but that they are often deprived of because they're in survival mode. They're just fighting for their ability to exist. And nobody should have to do this. And I think that that's what you get over and over and over again in these chapters, is these kids telling you that, like, that, yeah, they've survived, they've found a way to thrive, but it shouldn't have had to be this hard. Like, their childhoods shouldn't have had to be this difficult. They should just get to be like normal kids. And it's the one thing that we seem unwilling to give them. Yeah. It's hard being a kid.
You know what I mean? Like, being a kid sucks. Being a kid. It's like watching my daughter survive teenage years was almost as painful, if not more painful, actually, than me surviving. And then you add, you know, this on top of it. Nico, I don't know if you can, I don't even know if you can address this or not, because it sounds, at least from the beginning of your interview, that you had a supportive household. My daughter came out to me as non-binary, I guess, 3 years ago. And I've consent to share that information. And yet we hear so many stories, right, of kids whose families turn on them, kick them out, disown them. And as a parent, like, as like, my daughter is an extension of my being. I don't, there's nothing, like literally nothing she could do that could cause me to not love her. Like, nothing. I may not be happy with her about something, you know, she went out and like hurt a bunch of people, but nothing. I don't know if you spend any time talking to those people or listening to those people, and maybe you can just talk about the impacts for trans kids, teenagers, you know, in particular, that then lose their family support just for being. It like literally breaks my heart. I don't understand it. Can't.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It was one of the few things in this book I didn't really touch on as much, because I feel like that's a story that, and I'll tell you why. I think the why is really interesting here. That I think it's a story that trans kids already know, and that you hear over and over again, because they know in their, like, in their communities, in their schools, like, other kids who have experienced family rejection, or maybe they've experienced family rejection themselves, right? And it becomes the dominant narrative for a lot of youth. It was the dominant narrative, I think, for a really long time, that, you know, even when I was in college, you would hear this statistic that was banding it about, that 40% of homeless youth were LGBTQ+. And in certain communities, you hear that story a lot, like among like queer Mormon folks, you hear a lot about people being forced out of their homes and being forced onto the streets as they were coming out. And when we were pitching this book, that was one of the things that publishers pushed back on often, was that it didn't seem realistic to only have kids who come from relatively supportive households. But the thing is that I wanted to give kids a different story, that if they were a trans kid who was picking up this book because, you know, they hoped that it would reflect their experience in some way, like, I really wanted to expand the canon of stories. I wanted to hear from families that were supporting their kids, that had found a way to, like, work through their own, like, BS that they brought to this. Because, you know, like, parents aren't perfect. You've got a lot of baggage that you've got to work through to support a kid, right? Whether that kid is trans or not. There are so many ways in which being a parent, like, that's upends right. all of your own expectations, and you're constantly, like, growing and learning to support this child. That's not just a trans story. That's, like, all parents everywhere. So there are parents that are doing that. And then there are other parents who are struggling in their own ways, who do love and support their kids, but just have a hard time with certain things. You get one of those chapters in the book with Micah, who is a gender fluid teen in West Virginia. They are Black and biracial, but their mom is a white lesbian. And their mom, despite also being queer, has the hardest time of all the parents in the book, because, you know, she comes from an older generation. This is often used as an excuse, so I apologize for that. But in her case, it's true. Like, she comes from, like, a certain way that you talk about things about, you know, that you talk about gender. And she also came out late in life, so she had to do her own kind of, like, learning and catching up really late in general. And now it's like she's having to learn all these things with, like, respecting Micah's identity and the right pronouns to use, and just what these things mean, like, doing that education work again. And she's just really struggling, right? And she really beats herself up. But rather than, like, judging for her for that, what I hoped was to sort of, like, invite her in, to call her in, to recognize like who she is, the struggle she's been through, see her own humanity, because I think it's a way that we can encourage people to learn and to keep growing, that rather than judging them for all the things that they don't know and that they haven't gotten yet, we can sort of like use their like lack of like education in certain ways to just encourage them to do more, to be better, to keep trying. I started going to a Buddhist temple in LA that has been like the best thing I've done for myself in years. And a couple weeks ago, they said something really beautiful, that trying increases karma, that like essentially as long as you're trying, that is seen as being a net good. And I don't think trying is like, is everything, right? You can't just try forever and always be screwing up.
That's right.
But trying is a good place to start. And I felt like it was more important for these families and for these parents to just affirm that, like, please try. You might not be getting it all right. You might not have it all figured out. But even in your if you're in that place where you don't really affirm and accept your kids yet, you could. Please try. Look at all these families. Look how they did it. You know, and there are other families like you that are also having a hard time right now. So just keep going, because you can get there. And, you know, I want that for these kids more than anything.
You just brought tears to my eyes. Sorry. I mean, even with my politics, right? I had learning to do, have learning to do. Oh, gosh.
We all do.
There are kids. There are babies. Which is part of why I really, really wanted to talk to you about this book. News, Nico, about folks warring over the bodies and rights of trans kids, as you've highlighted here, is fairly common these days. But what is not common are the voices of trans kids themselves, which you have done really an amazing job of putting, you know, front and center. Talk about why that is so critically important.
Because we're just not listening to these kids. You know, there 650 anti-trans bills were introduced to, or have been introduced across the U.S. this year, right? And as I said before, the way that they're doing that, like part of the sort of like operational design of this is that they don't listen to the populations that are affected by this. You know, I'll give you all a couple stories so I don't repeat myself. You know, Ruby, my Texas girl, when she went to testify at the state legislature a few years ago against what I believe was an anti-trans sports ban then, but don't quote me on it if I'm wrong, you know, don't come for me, everyone. When she was brave enough to stand up and testify in front of these lawmakers, they didn't even look at her, right? They were like checking their phones. A lot of them didn't even like go to the hearing that day. This happened, I saw this up close in West Virginia, that when I went with Micah, my Black gender fluid kid there, to support people who were testifying at the legislature against an anti-trans medical care ban, like, again, most of the seats were empty in the room. Like, you know, you look down at the little amphitheater below where all the lawmakers should be sitting, and almost no one was there. I think there were only like 10 people. Right. It was really, 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 it was a really small turnout. And one of the anti-trans lobbyists like actually got up and said the quiet part out loud. They said that essentially the bill was a done deal, that no matter what the people there said that day, it didn't matter because it was going to pass. This was a Republican priority. And he said to the lawmakers that were present, you have to vote for this or we will vote you out. It's really that simple. I'm sort of paraphrasing there because I'm really bad at quoting people, but I think it literalizes what the game is here. They don't want to listen. They have no interest in listening to these kids. And with this book, I wanted to force them to try. You know, I said before, trying increases karma. This is my trying, right? I know that I don't have the ability to make every Republican lawmaker get it, right? Like, I don't have the ability to educate everyone, but it's my job as a journalist to try. And the way that I try is by centering the voices of these kids, because by hearing from them directly and hearing what their lives are like and hearing about what a not a big deal some of this stuff is, you know, it makes these things seem less scary. I do push back on the idea that the problem is that these people aren't educated and they don't know. A lot of them do know, actually. They know what they're doing is wrong. And they do it anyway because they're worried about getting voted out. They think that they have to support these policies.
That's a good segue to, and I was debating about whether or not I was going to ask you this, because it feels a little junior, if you will. Particularly given, like, you know, I mean, I'm a movement person. I've got an analysis, race, class, white supremacy, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at what's happening right now. And I'm wondering what you think is the actual political motivation of the right with this current wave of attacks. Like, what is the actual end goal here? And where do you see it sit in the middle of other right-wing attacks on our bodies and our lives, like with reproductive freedom, for example, or the white lash to defund, right? I just feel like that we can't inhale without another wave of something coming our way.
It's about power. It's always about power. It's about, like, the maintaining of power. It's about holding on to power. It's about consolidating power and taking away the rights of people who would challenge that power. Mm-hmm. Because it's like so many of these anti-trans policies are kind of a really nasty way of gerrymandering, right? That gerrymandering is about the idea that politicians get to pick their own constituents, right? Because usually in most countries, constituents pick their politicians. In our case, it's the opposite. And if you are a trans kid or the family of a trans kid and you can no longer exist in your state, you move. You see this also with trans adults as well, who have been forced to flee hostile states. And because of that, you know, those states get a little bit redder because of all of the people who no longer live there, right? There's sort of this vacuum that's created that Republicans fill just with more and more and more anti-trans policy. But I have been really heartened by seeing, you know, movements like the recent Gender Liberation March on Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. tie together some of the, like, anti-abortion policy and the anti-trans policy and the other just attacks on, like, on our safety and bodily autonomy that we're seeing. I did this story for them where I talked to the organizers of that event. And something that will always stick with me is I spoke to Genesis Gutierrez, who's an organizer of Familia TQLM and just, like, a longtime friend who I just really admire. And she said that if you are, like, an immigrant, right, and you are coming to the U.S. to, like, to pursue a better life, all of these arguments in these debates are all these debates about your life and your rights are about bodily autonomy. Because if you are in a lockup facility, if you're in an ICE center, like, you don't have bodily autonomy. You don't have freedom of movement. You don't have liberation. You don't get to decide what happens to your body on a daily basis. You don't even get to decide often what medical care you have. Mm-hmm. So all of these conversations end up sort of tying back to the same thing, which is, like, do people have freedom over their bodies? Do they have the right to make decisions about what happens to themselves and to determine their own futures? And that's really what these kids want. And, you know, they're fighting for the same thing. And I think the more that we can sort of recognize, like, ourselves and each other's struggles, the mm-hmm. more, like, we can sort of come together to fight together. But I do want to add one thing here before we move on, that Please. It's important to recognize our commonalities here, that we are fighting the same fight. But I hope we also show up for each other's fights, that even if, like, if Micah and I, you know, my West Virginia kid, even if we had, like, totally different stories and we had totally different, like, battles to fight, I would hope that Micah would show up for me and that I would show up for them. Like, in this book, I really wanted to emphasize the difference of all these kids, right? That they are so different from each other and that they, like, have these completely different stories and life experiences, because we shouldn't all have to be the same in order to, like, have community, you know, to have a movement. We should be able to get to be different and to fight for that difference. And I hope that we do more of that, fighting each other's battles and each other's struggles, and also just, like, creating space to be, like, as beautifully diverse as our community is. Like, why should we be the same?
Right. And shout out to Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw and her work on intersectionality. And you just very brilliantly captured the meaning of none of us are free until all of us are free. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Nico Lang. They have a new book out called American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. I want to transition now, Nico, to talking a little bit more about the impact on families. You mentioned that, like, folks have to move, and I think in the introduction to, well, I don't think, I know, in the introduction to your book, Susan Stryker refers to these families as internal refugees. Some of them even face criminal charges for supporting and loving their children. I'm wondering if you can talk to me about Kimberly Shapley and Kai.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to sort of overemphasize like Kimberly's point or like story too much just because their story's been told so often with, you know, with this book, I really wanted to highlight families that I feel like haven't been able to advocate for themselves as well as like Kimberly.
Then you and, pick. Like, you pick. Okay. You pick the story. Okay. And just tell it. How about that?
Okay. So let me do. How about, all right, let's focus on my Florida kids because I haven't, you know, I haven't really gotten to talk about them yet.
Okay.
So in Florida, I went to spend 2.5 weeks with a family there. The kids are Augie and Jack. You know, Augie is a trans girl. I believe she was 19 at the time. But these kids keep getting older, so I lose track of their ages. Mm-hmm. And then her sibling, Augie, is a 16-year-old non-binary kid, or was at the time. I loved getting to tell that story because it was a story about, you know, sort of these trans siblings and their bond. And I'd never really read that story before. So many of like the narratives in this book really appealed to me because I just hadn't really heard that before. You know, I hadn't seen that story told. And like, I always just want to keep expanding the canon and expanding more kinds of representation. But, you know, in addition to all that, Jack and Augie have really been through a lot. We'll start with Jack. Jack was detransitioned by state policy because she was one of the kids who relied on getting her gender affirming care through Medicaid. And in 2022, I believe, the state decided that it would no longer fund gender affirming care through that program. So all of the, or for youth. So all of the kids who were on that program were kicked off. Like they could no longer get their healthcare, which meant that Jack could no longer get her hormones. And she went without them for 5 months. I mean, you know, we're talking about bodily autonomy here. She didn't have it. Like her body was essentially forcibly taken away from her. And she had to just like slowly watch it disappear. And it was horrifying and debilitating. And it's an experience that I don't think she'll ever really like get over. Like that trauma is going to stay with her forever. But, you know, me being with her for those 2.5 weeks, spending that like that time with her, it was really about her trying to find her way again, like trying to find her like faith in the world or just like a reason to keep living and to go on. And for her sibling, Augie, they have a completely different story as like a non-binary teen. That's not really about gender affirming care. It's about their ability to be recognized as themselves, that mm-hmm. as a non-binary person, they told me that there are so few ways to get others to like recognize who they are, that there's not always like a visual cue to show other people that you're non-binary. So they're just getting misgendered mm-hmm. all the time. People That's very, right. very rarely correctly gender them. And it just doesn't always like, I don't know, they like, it doesn't always feel like they have a place in their home state and they just feel invisible all the time. And that can be really crushing. And I liked getting to highlight those two different perspectives and those two different stories because it reminds us that these kids aren't the same, that they have like wildly different experiences, wildly different like life outcomes a lot of the time, even siblings like in the same household, right? Occupying the same household in the same state, they still have such completely different stories. But, you know, at the end of that, they are still supporting each other. They are like lifting each other up and being each other's support through that. And I just thought that was a really beautiful story to highlight, especially in response to these like attacks on trans youth we're seeing, because we often haven't heard about this. Like we hear about that, oh, you know, Florida's doing this thing and it sounds like it's going to be bad. But then you don't hear from the people who are really impacted. And with Jack's story, you have that like very much illustrated for you how horrific these policies can be and how hard they are for folks who are forced to shoulder the burden of them. This should never happen to anyone. No one's medical care, should life-saving care, should be taken away from them, you know, at the drop of a hat, and especially not a 17-year-old child. Like, it's just her life shouldn't have had to be this hard, and it shouldn't be this hard for kids across the country.
I think you've made it clear who you wrote this book for. What is your hope for this book in the world?
Oh God, I have so many hopes for this book in the world. Mm-hmm. It's like giving birth to a child, you know? And you just like, I just wanted to grow up well. And I don't know. And I just have such hopes and dreams for it. There is actually this part in the book that every time I read it, I always cry. And I'm going to try not to cry now. But in Clint's chapter, he's my
Well, you just told
I
me
know.
We're
I'm just trying
though.
To make it through. I can cry. It's just more
cry.
Trying to make it through my points. You know, when you get crying, you get distracted from making the point. But in Clint's chapter, he's my Muslim Pakistani kid in Illinois. When he was born, his mom said something really beautiful. She said, "Assalamu alaikum. I'm so glad you're here. You're going to do great things." And it's so small, but I cry every time I read it because we have such like parents have such hopes for their children. You know, you give everything for your kids and you just want the world for them. And I want the world for these kids. I want the world for this book because I know that people really need it, that for all of the stories that are told in this book, there are so many stories that are untold. And there are so many stories that I just didn't get to tell in this because, you know, it would be 1,000 pages long and nobody has time for that. So you have to be like really clear and specific about the stories that you're telling. But it's really just the tip of the iceberg, that there are so many kids who are like suffering in silence out there whose, you know, stories aren't being told, who don't have journalists following them around for 2.5 weeks to document their lives. But then there are also kids who are experiencing such profound joy, right? And they never have that joy, that happiness, that like that elation represented. So I hope that this book more than anything inspires so many more books like it. Like I want this to be like, you know, when you watch old 70s sci-fi movies and you're like, God, they thought that's what special effects were. This looks like crap. Like I want 30 years from now, somebody to read this book and it feel totally outdated and obsolete. Like where they're just like, why would I read this? You know, this is like, this is hardly out of date. We don't think any of these things now. We've totally moved past all of this. And I want it to be like, I want that to happen. I want this book to feel out of date almost instantly. I want like society to learn and to grow and to for all of us to be better allies to these kids, right? That if we do the work and we create a better society for these children, for these literal children, books like this won't be necessary anymore. One of the kids just wrote an op-ed that will come out in Teen Vogue in a couple weeks. It might be already out by the time people listen to this interview. But he said something really profound to me, which was that no child should have to have a journalist follow them around for 2.5 weeks in order to convince other people that they deserve rights. So as much as I would love other books like this for it to be written, for you know us to keep representing the like wide diversity of the trans experience and trans youth experiences, I hope that this book is never necessary again. No kid should ever be forced to do this. And at some point we have to just let these kids be kids. We have to let them live their lives. And that's really like what I hope more than anything. My hopes like are beside this book, you know, beside people reading it. Like, I just want like trans kids to be able to move on from all this, to not have to think about this anymore, because it's just like, it's a horrible injustice we've been doing to them for too long. And it just needs to stop.
The way that I talk about that in my corner of the movement world, which is about state violence, right? I work with impacted families. As I say, I will retire from this work when what they call the radical becomes rational. Mm. One more question for you, Nico. And that is, so I just mentioned, you know, what I do for a living. And I know both as a journalist, I'm not a real journalist. I'm an activist that somebody was silly enough to give a platform to. But anyway, as a journalist and an activist / organizer, that holding, you know, the stories and the families isn't done by rote. It is an act of daily love and also personal sacrifice and compounds often our own grief and trauma. How do you hold it?
Oh, God. Some days not well, I've got to say, you know, writing this book, I don't want to sort of like overemphasize my own struggle or my own trauma here. But as a journalist, you're always like vicariously experiencing other people's trauma. But the thing is that when you're a reporter on the Daily News beat, you get to move past that a lot. Like, sure, it might be really hard to report this story for like a day, but you're onto a new story the next day and you're onto a new story the day after that. So you don't really get to sit with these feelings. But with this book, I was forced to sit with these feelings for 2 years. And that really got to me. Like, I had to get a therapist. Like, I started doing telehealth while I was reporting this book just because I was, you know, trekking all across the country and I just needed help. I needed my own support. And I think that, you know, it's a moment to remind all of us that we need to do better to support the mental health of journalists, because we can't do this alone. Like, we need help from our newsrooms. We need help from our colleagues. We need better healthcare. And we need better healthcare for freelancers, because I was a freelancer doing this. I didn't have a newsroom to support me. All this would have to be, you know, through my own volition. Right. And we just need to like support people who are doing the work, because otherwise we burn out and we just can't do this anymore. There are times doing this I didn't know if I would be able to do it anymore. But I will say that the way I have sort of held space for all of this better is by having better mental health practices myself. You know, I mentioned Buddhism earlier, that's been really critical for me. I feel like I'm sort of developing this like little bingo card, or like just taking a shot game where every time I bring up being a Buddhist now, but like you can take a shot because I'm going to talk about it again. And I do feel like it's been a really good practice for me to have this space that I go to every week where I can like just distance myself from like the suffering of the world, or just embrace it, right? Like a lot of the time Buddhism, you sort of like have to go through to get out of it. And, you know, because Buddhism recognizes suffering is a part of life. Suffering is a part of existence. And it's such a part of my work. I can't just escape it. Right. Even if I wanted to pretend that people aren't out there having a hard time or experiencing terrible tragedies, like it would just be impossible. It's my line of work. So it's really helped me, like, rather than having my coping mechanism be just pretending that all this, you know, isn't happening when I'm off the clock. It's like, how do I make peace with this? Like, how do I sort of like let it in? There was this really great parable a few weeks ago where they talk about the idea of like drawing black smoke into your body in order to essentially like take on the pain of other people. But then through that, you cleanse the smoke. And then you just like breathe out like light and goodness. And I'd always looked at my job as kind of like you're breathing in the smoke and you're just holding it for everybody else. And then eventually like you suffocate. It was for me very freeing to hear that the act of like taking on like this level of like trauma for other people could actually be like a transformative experience for all of us. So I think that's what I sort of take moving forward, is like, how can I, rather than just, you know, shouldering the burden of this or like putting it on my back, how can I be transformed by it? You know, how can I use it to keep being a better advocate, to be a better person, and to just make the world a slightly better place? And that's, you know, sort of what I'm trying to stay focused on. And, you know, in the day to day, I sometimes do make space for this by having other things in my life. Like, I have a lovely husband who is an incredible support for me. I watch a lot of old movies, like black and white screwball comedies are like my jam. And any chance I get, I'm always trying to find like a new hidden gem. And it's just having a full, well-rounded life the way that these kids do. Because something I really made space for in the book is that these kids get to be like multifaceted and idiosyncratic. And that's what I want for all of us. I don't want my job to just define me or to like only be, you know, to be the only thing about my life. I want to have just like a really wide range of experiences. I want life to continue to surprise me. And when people read the book, I hope it surprises them. I hope that they like see these kids for the full richness of their lives, for everything that they have to offer, that they recognize that even this book, for, you know, all of its depth, is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more here.
All right, Nico Lang, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today was Nico Lang. Lang is a journalist, editor, culture critic, and essayist, the founder of Queer News Daily, and has previously worked as the deputy editor of Out Magazine, an LGBTQ+ correspondent for Vice, the news editor at Them, and a contributing editor at Extra Magazine. Their book that we've been discussing today is American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. That's it for the day, fam bam. Law and Disorder airs weekdays at 8 a.m. Check for information about topics, guests, and featured artists online at kpfa.org. Listen, subscribe to the podcast version of the show by searching for Law and Disorder with Kat Brooks, and follow us on social media at Law and Dis. Holler at me about something you heard or send a show idea to lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. A huge thanks to the squad. Producers are Teresa Wiersbianska and Diana Martinez, engineer Kirsten Thomas, show theme music Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5, Palestine Post theme music by Palestinian-American composer Eccentric, Resistance and Residence theme music Black Smoke by Kenny Brooks and Alphabet Soup. Your host is me, Kat Brooks. If you're on the other side of the walls and want to send a letter, you can write to Law and Disorder, care of Kat Brooks, KPFA 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California 94704. We will occasionally read your letters on the air. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Democracy Now! Is up next at 9 o'clock.